to start with what is quite evident, which we and all other living beings, no matter who they are, whether they're humans or mosquitoes or whatever, all living beings simply want happiness and freedom from suffering. Our difficulty is that we don't know what causes happiness and what causes misery. And so we often shoot ourselves in the foot by doing things that we think will bring us happiness, but because we're ignorant about how karma works and how our mind works, the things we do often lead us to unhappiness instead. And so now we've encountered the Buddha Dharma, we have a chance to learn it, to put it into practice, to really learn what causes happiness and what causes misery, to gain confidence into that, in that something more than just lip service, so that it really changes how we live our life, what we choose to do, and what we choose not to do. And so while we're learning and working on this, let's do it with a very broad and expansive mind, a mind that is open-minded to new ideas, and a mind that can include within it the fact that other living beings are just as important as we are. Because each of us calls ourselves I, and so each of us feels, I want to be happy, I don't want to suffer. I want to be respected, I want to be secure. Everybody feels that equally. So there's no reason to cherish our own welfare over others. And so let's have a big mind that wants to eliminate misery, no matter whose it is, simply because it's misery, and a mind that wants to create happiness, no matter whose it is, simply because it's happiness. And so with that kind of attitude of compassion and altruism, let's follow the path to full awakening so we can actually bring about the welfare of others without wasting a lot of time and energy, without tripping ourselves and others up. So generate that altruistic intention for listening to the teachings and also for the whole weekend retreat. So we finished number 12, didn't we? So we're in the middle of talking about the Bodhisattva precepts that have to do with ethical conduct. Okay, and so the next one is a real doozy. Yeah, and it reads, being distracted by and having a strong attachment to amusement or without any beneficial purpose, leading others to join in distracting activities. Okay, this is in the Red Prayer Book, page 80, number 13. Okay, so being distracted by and having strong attachment to amusement. Anybody here have that? Yeah, just, you know, what kind of amusement? Well, the TV, the internet. Yeah, the news is really amusing nowadays, isn't it? Yeah, we find all sorts of things to amuse ourselves with. Yeah, we look at catalogs. Yeah, so, you know, vacuum cleaner catalogs, garden seeds for your garden catalogs. I fly a lot, so people take out these magazines, you know, what you're supposed to look at in the planes and all the things you can buy. Yeah, and they look at that. It's so boring. So we really like amusement. We want to go out singing and dancing and Christmas caroling and to parties and discos and out having a lot of fun. Okay, maybe just out to dinner. All the things that we usually enjoy. And here it's saying being distracted by them and having strong attachment to them. Okay? So being distracted by, what does that mean? It means that we have an opportunity with our precious human life to really learn the Dharma and focus on the Dharma. But we have a really hard time finding time to do it. Why? Because we're distracted by things that are much more amusing than sitting down and having to study a Dharma text. Yeah? Or just even read a Dharma text. Yeah. So, it's much more entertaining to listen to the latest White House scandal. It's quite entertaining nowadays, isn't it? Yeah? And much more entertaining to, you know, go play golf. Yeah, maybe you'll run into Donnie on the golf course. So we get distracted by all these other things. So we never get around to really studying the Dharma, okay, putting it into practice. So distracted by it and having strong attachment. So it's like, I really want to do this. Yeah. I really want to play this computer game. It's so interesting, fascinating. Yeah. And they say it'll prevent me from getting Alzheimer's. Isn't that what they're supposed to do, you know? Because it keeps you awake, how many little things you can shoot down and, playing solitaire playing solitaire with a computer, yeah? We are amused strongly and strongly attached to these things. And often, Saturdays and Sundays. I'm not saying people shouldn't relax and enjoy. You know, it's fine to relax and enjoy, but we do go a little bit beyond that. Yeah, to just zoning out in front of the tube all weekend. Anybody do that? You watch football, then golf, then basketball, then, you know, or maybe you watch what? Saturday Night Live, yeah. That's actually good. They make fun of the president. Yeah, I think laughing is very important nowadays. Yeah, Saturday Night Live. When I was little, it was the Lawrence Welk show on Saturday night. Yeah, anybody remember Lawrence Welk on Saturday night? and Ed Sullivan on Sunday night. Yeah, you remember that? Yeah, never missed it. So now, instead of that, they have other things. Yeah, poor Lawrence Welkin. Do you remember that? They all did the dancing. Yeah. So we never get any Dharma practice done because we have our social engagements, we have our hobbies, we have our family dinners. My sister's getting married on Sunday. Yeah, and I chose to be here with you instead of at the wedding. Yeah. So I'm going to miss out on the party and the cocktails and the dancing. And they're having a fun weekend. They're going golfing and swimming and all sorts of stuff. And I'm sitting here with you, which I am much happier doing than going to a wedding reception where you can't even hear people talk because the music's so loud. As much as I love my sister. Yeah. Yeah. What I really want to see in the wedding probably takes about 45 seconds. I want to see her two kids walk her down the aisle. The rest of it, yeah, I hope she doesn't watch this teaching. Yeah. But, you know, for them, it's fun. For me, it's something else. But, you know, I have my other things that I'm attached to doing. Yeah, you give me a long walk in the forest and, you know, and I'll go for it. Okay, but so, you know, we need exercise. That's fine. We need some relaxing time. But this is talking about keeping ourselves as the busiest of the busy to the detriment of our spiritual practice. Yeah, and the disadvantages of doing that is that having the opportunity that we have now with a precious human life took us a long time, many lifetimes, to create the karmic causes to have it. And yet this life doesn't last very long. It comes and it goes. And at the time of death, we can't say, hold on, I'm not ready. You know, can I have a few more years? I promise to turn off the TV and the internet and stop going to parties and doing some Dharma practice now. Give me a little bit more time. You know, so who are you going to bargain with? Yeah, at the time of death, who can we complain to? It's not fair. Yeah. Who can we bargain with? Give me a little bit more time. It's no sweat off your back. There's nobody to bargain with. You know, it's just cause and effect. So, you know, if we've chosen to spend our time in distraction, then, you know, we need to accept responsibility for probably dying in a lot of confusion and turmoil. Now, if we, you know, don't get so distracted and keep our mind focused on what's important and do some serious practice, then dying can be very relaxing. They say even for the very great practitioners, it's like going on a picnic. They feel so happy. Okay, so, you know, it's not anybody saying you're not supposed to be distracted, this is bad. Nobody's saying that. It's just up to us to choose how to spend our time being aware of what are the results of distraction and what are the results of study and practice of the Dharma. Okay? So what this has to do with... And also with this is without any beneficial purpose, leading others to join in distracting activities. You know, like somebody wants to come to retreat, you talk them out of it. Or somebody wants to do their evening practice, but you say, oh, come on, let's go do this and that instead. Okay? So bringing others to distraction and preventing them from practice, which is, you know, many people see that as showing kindness to their loved ones, but that's because they don't understand karma and rebirth. You know, if you understand that, then you realize that distracting your loved ones from the Dharma is harming them. It's not being kind to them. Okay? So, you know, we just waste a lot of time singing and dancing and laughing and being very excited, you know. You know how it is sometimes when you get with your friends and you just carry on and you're laughing hysterically and everybody's just being really silly. You all look so serious right now, you know, but you're doing all of that. You know, so then it does something to our mind too. It makes our mind quite restless and it makes our actions very careless, especially if we're drinking and drugging when we're together with our friends. Yeah, and then, yeah, it leads to a lot of carelessness. And it's so funny because we always say, we read about what happens to people when they get drunk in the newspaper, but we always think, oh, I would never do anything like that. But the people who do those things and then wind up either in trouble themselves or being victimized by somebody else, they didn't think they would ever wind up in that kind of situation either. Yeah. So, you know, when you add alcohol and drugs to this kind of thing, then our behavior really gets careless and all over the place. Okay? So this is, one of the precepts. So this is a tough one to keep, isn't it? Yeah, it's tough because we are attached to amusement and excitement and our social life and everything, yeah? Okay, then 14 is believing and saying that followers of the Mahayana should remain in cyclic existence and not try to attain liberation from afflictions. So this one is easier to keep without transgression, okay? So what this means is somebody is looking at the Mahayana tradition, yeah, the Bodhisattva vehicle in particular, and saying that the people that follow this should remain in cyclic existence and should not try to attain liberation, yeah? And the reason this is, the people who believe this have misunderstood the teachings, okay? And how did they do that? It's because there's certain sutras that say that bodhisattvas take delight in being in samsara, okay? Now, a bodhisattva is somebody who has that spontaneous altruistic intention wanting to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. When it says that those people take delight in samsara, it doesn't mean the way we take delight in samsara. You know, it's not because they're going out to parties and looking for a good reputation and a lot of money and going on cruises and so on and so forth. It's they delight in being born in the samsaric world in order to have contact with ordinary, afflicted living beings like us to be able to teach us and guide us on the path. Okay, so they don't like samsara because samsara is a lot of fun because they've actually seen that samsara is a big hellhole. Yeah, So when the scriptures say, oh, they don't seek liberation because they enjoy samsara, it means that they're not seeking their own personal liberation, but they're choosing to come back in this confused world for the benefit of the rest of us. Okay? Actually, they want to attain liberation. They want to attain full awakening. Yeah? But instead of attaining their own liberation, their own state of personal peace, of nirvana, yeah, they've chosen to stay in this world and accumulate merit by being of benefit to sentient beings so that they can attain the state of full awakening or Buddhahood, yeah, which is a higher state than the state of liberation attained by arhats. Okay, so they're willing to spend longer time accumulating merit in order to attain full awakening, you know. And it's just that they do that here. I mean, they're giving up their own bliss for the sake of attaining full awakening to be able to benefit us. Okay? So we don't believe or say that they should remain in samsara and not try and attain liberation from afflictions. Yeah. Because their aim is to attain full awakening, because then they'll have all the wisdom, compassion, power, skillful means, and so on necessary to benefit others. Okay, is that clear, people? Okay, then number 15, not abandoning destructive actions that cause you to have a bad reputation. Okay, now you're going to go, but I thought we weren't supposed to be attached to our reputation. Isn't that one of the eight worldly concerns, being attached to our reputation? So why is there this one here about, you know, abandoning things that cause me to have a bad reputation? Okay. Well, here, first of all, what we're abandoning is destructive actions that we shouldn't be doing anyway, even for our own sake. Okay, there's no benefit to those actions. And as a bodhisattva, if we're practicing the bodhisattva path, we need to have a good reputation. Okay, so, but the reason for having it is very different from the reason we worldly beings want a good reputation. Okay, because we want a good reputation because it bolsters our lack of self-confidence, it masks our insecurity. We can get certain perks from it. Maybe people will give us presents and we get high status and we'll get privilege. Okay, so we want a good reputation simply for very self-centered reasons. Yeah. Bodhisattvas want a good reputation because they realize that if they're going to be of any benefit to others, other people are going to have to respect them. Okay? If they do destructive actions and they act any old which way, then ordinary people aren't going to respect them. They aren't going to want to learn from them. And then bodhisattvas will be unable to do what to fulfill their aspiration, which is to benefit sentient beings. Okay? Communicating? Yeah? So this is a situation. For example, maybe we made a mistake and so somebody criticizes us for that mistake. Yeah? And we're having a bad reputation because of it. But we just say, well, who cares? You know, I don't care what they think of me, you know, whatever they think, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And that's being quite irresponsible because then that other, we're cutting off our ability to benefit that person because they won't respect us. And we've made a big mistake and we're not owning it. We're not being responsible for it. So why should they respect us and want to learn the Dharma from us? That's ridiculous. Okay? So if we made a mistake and people are criticizing us for it, and we have a bad reputation, we should definitely apologize to those people and make amends and, you know, be responsible for our actions, because that will at least show them that we have some integrity and some consideration for others. Okay? On the other hand, sometimes people misinterpret things we say or do, and they get mad at us for and criticize us for something that we didn't do. And again, a transgression here is just saying, well, you know, forget it. Those people are so stupid. They are accusing me of something I didn't really do. Just forget it, you know. And so having that attitude too, again, impedes our being able to benefit those people. So if there was a misunderstanding and they're criticizing us and not, you know, they don't have a good feeling for us because of this misunderstanding, then we need to explain what we did and clear the air. Yeah. Because it is important that we have good relationships with people and that they see us as somebody who is trustworthy, who has integrity, who assumes responsibility, okay, instead of just kind of shining things on. Okay. Now, if there may be certain situations where we feel that even if we try to clear the air, the other person is not going to listen. Or maybe they're just going to even get angrier. In those kind of situations, then it's not a transgression to not go and talk and apologize and so on. Okay, but in general, we should try and keep things clear. Okay? Yeah? So we care about our reputation, but not for self-centered reasons. Okay, then number 16 is not correcting your own afflictive actions or not helping others to correct theirs. Okay, so, you know, we may be doing all sorts of negative actions. And again, just saying, well, so what? Yeah, I don't care what other people think. I don't care about my car. I'm going to do what I want to do. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. And anyway, I do most of these things where other people don't see me. So, you know, who kind of cares if I do negative actions or not? Yeah. Yeah, we definitely have that attitude, don't we? Yeah. If I do it and nobody knows, then it's really not so bad. Yeah, it doesn't ruin my reputation. Yeah. But karma, you know, doesn't care about reputation. We still accumulate the negative karma. So we need to, you know, correct our own afflictive actions. And here, it's also a transgression is not helping others to correct theirs. So here's a situation in which somebody is about to do a very serious destructive action, you know, harm somebody else or self-sabotage, or they're, you know, really about to make a big mistake. And we don't do anything to talk to them or to distract them or to change the conditions so that they don't do it, because we're afraid that if we say anything, they'll get mad at us. Okay, we have this problem, don't we? Yeah, we see people, you know, saying things that are not helpful, doing destructive actions, but we don't want to say anything because they may get mad at us. And we don't want people to be mad at us. So there are avoiding people being mad at us and criticizing us is more important to us than caring about whether they create horrific negative karma. That's pretty self-centered, isn't it? Because we're just like, I don't want anybody to scream at me. I don't want anybody to think bad of me. I want to have a good reputation. I want everybody to like me. I'm not going to risk my reputation to interfere in this. Yeah, very self-centered. Okay, so you know, we're afraid of offending them. We're afraid they'll get irritated. They won't like us. Yeah, but we have to see that if we really have compassion for somebody, sometimes it means saying things very clearly to them, and they may get upset with us. But if we're doing it with a good intention and it serves the purpose of preventing them from creating some serious destructive karma, then who cares whether they like us or don't like us? Okay? So, you know, the previous one, we were just not caring about our reputation and so not fixing things up, which is detrimental for others because then they don't want to hear teachings from us or whatever. This one is we're not brave enough to say something to them that will stop them from harming themselves or harming others because, you know, we just want to be people pleasers and have everybody think we're wonderful. Huh? So I've talked about this many times, you know, in the community, that it, you know, it's so important that we help each other when we see somebody is going down a slippery slope, that we don't just stand by and let them go down a slippery slope and create a lot of negative karma because we're so attached to people liking us. Yeah. So this is involving a situation where somebody's really, they're really doing something that's not good. We're not talking here about correcting tiny faults. Yeah, we're not talking here about becoming the world's policeman or policewoman, picking at everybody over their tiny faults and correcting them, thinking that we're doing very good. Because doing that is not coming from a compassionate attitude. That is our wanting to control other people. Okay, so we have to discriminate many different states of mind here and really see what our motivation is. Yeah, if we're picking at people, you put your shoes this way, they're supposed to be this way. You know, you didn't do this and you should have done that. And just, you know, picking at people with a negative intention, yeah, because you're trying to make them be what you want them to be. Yeah, that's definitely something to abandon. Doing that is not the definition of keeping this precept. Okay, here we're talking about, you know, well, you read at these frat parties. We've been reading so much in the news about these, you know, the frat parties and the kids behaving, doing stupid things, and people dying in, you know, during rush. What do you call it? Rushing? Yeah, when they're rushing, or you know, to become a member of a fraternity or a sorority, or you know, hazing also, you know. So all this kind of stuff. In sports teams it happens. You know, so people do this kind of thing and they think, oh, this is really clever and let's see, you know, put everybody through the test. And then we read it. We have been reading about young people dying in these situations and nobody being responsible. You know, the one that's been in the news recently You know, they made him drink some incredible amount of alcohol within a very short time. His blood alcohol was like, I don't know how many times greater. I mean, some incredible, I don't know, 4 times or 8 times greater than what it is to be drunk. The guy fell down the stairs, injured himself. Well, the other kids put him on a sofa. Gee, that's really nice. But, you know, he's bleeding, he's unconscious. And he died the next morning, still drunk. And now these kids at the frat party are having, they're facing charges for involuntary manslaughter and neglect and things like that. So this is the kind of situation. I'm not talking about picky stuff, you know, where somebody's really doing something that's not smart, that's very damaging. But you don't want to say anything because all your other friends are going to think that you're weird. You know, if you say, hey, we shouldn't be giving people so much alcohol to drink in a short time, or if you say, you know, we should really take him to the ER room, and you're, but you don't say anything because you're afraid your friends are going to think you're prudy and weird and like that, then that's what we're talking about here. But so that's a big example, and all of us are beyond doing that because we're no longer teenagers. So we think, you know, we don't have that problem. Of course, we take somebody to ER. But we find all sorts of other ways to not intervene if something, somebody's doing something quite harmful. You know, we may have a relative who, you know, has a drug alcohol problem. We don't say anything. We become enablers because they'll get mad at us if we point out to them that they have a problem. Friends are about to do a really bad business deal. We don't say anything to them. It's a kind of, the legality of it is iffy or whatever it is. We don't say anything because they might get mad at us. So these kinds of things. So again, it doesn't mean we go around correct everybody over every tiny things, but we speak up when things need to be spoken up about. So in a monastic situation, we do this. This is, you know, the whole thing about giving each other advice and how important it is in a community to advise each other when we see somebody going down a slippery slope. So we do it when they're still at the top of the slope. We don't wait until they're 2/3 of the way and they're about to crash at the bottom. That's not very compassionate. So this particular precept is contrary to the ethical conduct of helping others because we are letting them make serious mistakes. So those number 8 to 16, those 9 precepts are for ethical conduct, that, you know, helping us to keep good ethical conduct. It's very interesting as we go through many of the other ones to come, many of them are also relate back to the 3 kinds of ethical conduct of not restraining, of doing virtuous, not restraining harmful actions, of doing virtuous actions, and of benefiting sentient beings. So many of the precepts actually pertain to more than one of the 6 perfections. Now we're going to eliminate obstacles to the perfection of fortitude. So there's only 4 here. So we think, you know, only 4 things having to do with anger. I can make it through this one, you know. Maybe, you know, my anger's not so bad. Well, okay, let's start with number 17, which is the first one. Okay. It's returning insults with insults, returning anger with anger, returning somebody beats us up, we beat them up, and returning criticism with criticizing them. Sounds very human, doesn't it? Isn't that what most of us do? Somebody insults us. Somebody verbally abuses us. Yeah. Do we put our hands together and say, thank you so much, you just helped me use up some negative karma. Thank you so much, you're giving me the opportunity to practice patience. We don't do that when somebody insults us and abuses us. We throw a fit and we yell back at them and let them know that they can't, in no uncertain terms, that there's no way they can speak to us this way. Yeah, so we insult them back and we verbally abuse them back and we throw it all back in their face. Yeah, it's called getting defensive, but other people call it sticking up for yourself. Yeah. That, you know, and we're often taught as children, this is what you should do. Yeah, somebody calls you a name, you call them a name back. Yeah, really useful, isn't it? Yeah, that's what is going on at the highest level of government, what people are doing. They're just calling each other names. Nobody's trying to make good policies or, you know, do anything for the people. They're just calling each other names. But we're not like that, are we? No. We're civil. We're better than those politicians. Yeah. But, you know, we do. Somebody insults us, we insult them back. So the practice of fortitude here is not returning insults with more insults. Now, the question is going to come, how in the world do you do that? Okay, well, to avoid doing that, you have to not, you know, not be so reactive when other people insult you. Yeah? You have to be able to hold your center and realize when other people insult you, that they're basically saying more about themselves than they are about you. Yeah? And to hold our center. But I was thinking, you know, when Jan Willis was here last weekend, and she was telling us a situation. What was it? Where she got very offended. It had to do with race. Oh, yes. She was at some of going to visit her parents. No, her friend's parents. Yeah, that she already knew. And they kind of expressed some shock that, you know, oh, you're black and you're coming into our home, even though she knew the family. And she came to understand later it's because there were some troubles between the blacks and the Jews in that community at that time. But still, she was very hurt. She was very offended by that. And most people would be. Yeah. So it made me, you know, when she told that story, it made me remember a situation when I was in seventh grade. Okay. So I was raised Jewish in the shadow of the Holocaust with, you know, you got to be careful, and they just killed 6 million of us, and so on. And it was a Monday morning, I think, and it was current events class. And one boy in my seventh grade class, Peter Armetta, I'm waiting to meet someday, he said something to the effect of, why don't all you Jews leave the country and go back where you came from? And I, you know, being, how old are you? I was 12, okay? I just took this to the heart. I ran out of the seventh grade class. Poor Mr. Reese didn't know what happened to me. Went in the girls' bathroom, cried all day. I refused to go back into my seventh grade classroom. I was so hurt, so offended, so insulted. Yeah. And I realized years later that I had been taught that when people made anti-Semitic remarks, I was supposed to be angry and I was supposed to be insulted and enraged. Yeah, that you learn these kinds of things. Yeah. And after I met the Dharma, I began to see, you know, at that time you actually have a choice. You can choose to be offended, or you can choose not to be offended. Yeah. Now, for some people, the reaction of being offended is like so instantaneous. And, you know, it lasts for years and years and years. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, everybody is almost a member of some kind of minority or another, and we all have reasons to feel insulted and offended. Yeah. So I'm not saying those reasons are invalid. What I'm saying is that we do have a choice. Yeah. And if you choose not to be offended and not to reply with to insults with insults, it doesn't mean that you just let somebody go on talking in a bigoted way. Okay? So we shouldn't think that having fortitude means that you become the doormat. Yeah. You can be completely calm and not feel offended, but know that this is a time where you need to educate somebody. And you need to give somebody some feedback so that they understand the effect of their speech on other people. You getting what I'm saying? Yeah? That instead of responding with, like I did, crying in the bathroom all day, crying in the bathroom all day, that was something okay for girls to do. You know, if I had been a boy, I probably would have been, you know, yelled and screamed and gone over and punched him because that's what you're supposed to do when you're a boy. Okay, but to realize how, you know, this is conditioned behavior, and there is a choice in there. When she told that story, so it made me recognize that situation where I was insulted for being Jewish. Then it made me remember another situation where I was insulted for not being Jewish. Okay, so the second situation happened, oh my goodness, many years ago, I can't remember, but I was teaching in Israel, and one of my friends, part of her family, lived in the West Bank. You know, they were part of the settlers who lived in the West Bank. And they invited us over to dinner. You know, they invited my friend, and she said, I want to bring some friends with, you know, and they said, sure. So we got there, and then, you know, I think she may have told them beforehand, you know, that I was raised Jewish, and it's not just raised Jewish, you are Jewish. Yeah, when you're Jewish, you know, this thing that we say on Passover, let my people go, it's not just talking to the Pharaoh, you know? It's the Jewish community will not let you go. And, yeah, so I was going to this Shabbat meal, and I was a Buddhist, but I was, in their eyes, really Jewish. And I was a traitor because I was not remaining Jewish and I had another religion. And when we came in and my friend was introducing me to her aunt and uncle, they did not look at me. They did not shake my hand. They did not say hello the entire evening. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a very interesting experience. So there, again, I could have chosen to be very offended because the way they were acting was anything but hospitable and, you know, open or anything like that. But by that, but I, at that time, you know, I knew how people think, yeah? And you realize that's just how they think. Nothing you say is going to make any difference. Forget it. Just enjoy being there, yeah? So that's what I did. You know, my friend, of course, was very apologetic on behalf of her relatives. And I said, it doesn't matter, just, I know the culture. There's no reason for me to get upset. I, you know, this is what they do. Yeah. Later on, I think the same trip or another trip, there was one young woman who had been in a car accident or something, and she was unconscious and at a hospital. And so her friends asked me to go, you know, and do some prayers and so on. I don't know if she may have been to one Buddhist course or something. She definitely wasn't Buddhist. She was from a Jewish family. And her uncle from New York. Yeah, if you know anything about New York Jews going to Israel, they are the most conservative of the conservative. These are the ones who, you know, they move into the West Bank for ideological reasons. It's not like the Russian Jews who live in the West Bank because they're poor and they can get housing there. These people deliberately move there because it's their land and they're going to claim it. So her uncle from New York was there. And so I went and I did some prayers and things like that. And as I was leaving, her uncle said, "Don't forget you're always Jewish." So again, I could have been really offended and said, you know, who do you think you are? You're so bigoted against people or other religion. What's the use? You know, I wasn't really offended. I know how people think. Yeah? In this particular case, I chose, you know, in both these cases, I didn't say anything to the people because I knew it wouldn't have done any good. Yeah? Now, going back to Peter Armetta in seventh grade, you know, if I had been on top of the situation then I could have done a very nice NVC statement. Yeah? That would have let, you know, Peter know that this kind of speech is uncalled for and it's painful and so on. And I could have said that even if I personally wasn't offended. but to let him know that other people would certainly be hurt by that. But of course, I was too busy crying in the bathroom to do that. Okay, so I got off on a little tangent here, but I hope these examples kind of are showing how to deal with some of these things, yeah? Or at least how to try and apply some dharma to real life situations. Mm-hmm. Okay, then, I won't even tell you the stories about facing discrimination because I'm a woman in the Tibetan community. I won't even go into that. Yeah. But I'm sure many women here, and I mean, everybody has stories, don't we, of some kind or another where people, you know, were just out and out prejudiced against us. Yeah. So that's one example here of being insulted. Or it could be somebody on a personal level who's insulting you, not because they're you know, bigoted, but because, you know, they're mad at you for one reason or another. Yeah, because sometimes we make mistakes. I know we shouldn't talk about that, but we do. Yeah, so they say things. Okay, not returning anger with anger. Somebody's mad at us. Yeah, we usually get mad at them back, don't we? And our anger is justified. Even if we withdraw and don't speak and we're hurt, especially if you've been socialized not to express anger, but instead to cry, you know, even you go cry, you're angry. You're angry. So we're still replying to anger with anger. Yeah. Somebody beats us, yeah, we punch him back. Yeah, very good for the hospitals. They make a lot of money on us retaliating. I mean, you think the what is it, the murder rate in Chicago now? There's been all sorts of articles about that, way up, you know, horrible murder rate, and just shootings in general. Why? Retaliation. Yeah? Somebody does something you don't like, you shoot him back, or you beat him, or you stab him, or do something. Yeah? How many people die because of this? Too many. This also goes into national policy, doesn't it? Yeah, what did the French do after the thing in Paris? They sent their jets to go bomb in Syria, didn't they? Okay, and then we respond to criticism with criticism. Yeah, and that's what we do when we fight people. We fight with especially the people we care the most about. Yeah, most of our fights, aren't they just one person criticizing the other and the other criticizing that one back? Isn't that what most of marital fights are about? Yeah. Or fights with, you know, your good friends, or fights with your kids. Yeah. You're so fill in the blank. And then they say, but you're so fill in the blank. I mean, you could write a whole script for it and then just fill in the blank as you wish. Yeah. But this is what we do. You're so da 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 because you did da 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 da, which means you don't care anything about me, da 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 da. Well, you did da 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 da, and that means blah, 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 and you don't care about me either. So, you know, this pot calling the kettle black. Blah. Yeah. What about number 13, being distracted by and having strong attachment to amusement? Some people like fighting. Have you met people like that who love to fight? I tried to work with somebody who loved to fight. I didn't know this about them when I first started working with them. They seemed like a really nice person. And there were a few little red flags, but I ignored those. And then I realized that this person loved to fight. You know? That's just how he got clarity on his ideas, how he got a feeling of communication with somebody, how, you know, he just loved it. I didn't. Yeah. I'm not a yeller and screamer. So he would like go on attack mode, and I remember one time I just stood up and walked away. Oh boy. He was so furious when I walked away. Okay. So, you know, number 17 is about how we respond to these difficult kind of situations. Yeah, and we usually respond in kind. And how does the situation usually end? Badly, doesn't it? With people saying all sorts of horrible things to the people they care about the most. People harming each other physically so that everybody suffers afterwards. Yeah. Often when I go into prisons, you know, and the guys have asked me to give a talk, I'll give a talk and I'll say, how many of you are here because of anger? Every hand, or almost every hand, goes up. Yeah. How many of you are here because of anger? Does anger really help you? Yeah, it gives you a sense of power, but does it really help? Okay, that was number 17. Anybody have anything they want to add to this one?
Even if I'm not responding to someone, having a malicious intent towards them and going off and like just, you know, running around what they did in my head and why they're bad and, you know, just wasting vast amounts of time and energy.
Yeah. It's true. We can waste a lot of time and energy because we ruminate. And we run the situation through again and again, you know. And with inside of us, we have a judge, a jury, and a prosecutor. And we rerun the situation, prosecuting that other person in our mind for whatever thing they did, you know. We convict them. The jury in us convicts them. And the judge gives them a death sentence or, you know, something severe enough. You are now worthy of my eternal hatred. Yeah. So we spend hours, don't we? Anybody here like to ruminate about what somebody did to you that wasn't fair and it wasn't right and they should know better and they shouldn't treat us that way anyway, and you know. Yeah, a lot of time.
Venerable, I have a question. It's not related with the number 17, but more on your stories about Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do you handle some kind of like a situations where you are neither here nor there? Like you said, as a Jew, people call you immigrants, but on the other hand, the Jewish community itself does not really accept you because you are a Buddhist, but you are also not Tibetan. Aren't you like confused, like identity crisis? You know, I'm neither here nor there.
Yeah, okay. So you say, doesn't this kind of bring an identity crisis, you know? It's like the Tibetans don't accept me because I'm a Westerner, and the Westerners don't accept me because I'm a Tibetan nun, and the Jews don't accept me because I'm Buddhist, and the Buddhists don't accept me because, you know, I grew up Jewish, and, you know, so don't I get confused about who I am? No. No. I feel very happy having a rather fluid identity like that. And I've spent a good part of my adult life living in other countries, and I really cherish that because I'm not, you know, I don't think like a particular nationality. I mean, I've taken some things from all the different cultures that I've lived in and adopted that into the way I think or the way I act. And so I feel quite comfortable with that. Like I got to pick the best thing from everybody. Yeah.
I wanted to share a story kind of related to that and also to precepts number 16 and 17, where last year we were in East Malaysia, where the Chinese are a minority and the Muslims are a majority, and Malay Muslims are majority in Malaysia. And we were at this lunch where someone, a Chinese Buddhist, started to say things about the Muslim community and how, you know, his own fear as a minority and coming out as racial hatred. And at that moment, I got paralyzed, you know, like, I know the culture, I know the fear, I feel ashamed of racism coming from other Chinese people, I feel guilt that I'm supposed to identify with being Chinese, like, all this identity stuff happening, I was like, but I don't believe anything he says. And all Venerable did to break that silence was just to say, I'm really uncomfortable when you talk about groups of people as if they were all one thing, and especially if groups, if those people are not represented here. Like, I remember you speaking up like that, and it just shifted the whole conversation. Mm-hmm. And I felt so relieved that you spoke up to indicate the effect of someone speaking like that. Yeah. Whereas I think maybe everyone at the table, because everyone was Chinese, maybe would have not said anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A few years ago when you taught these Venerable, it wasn't striking me in this way at all. But now looking at 16, mm-hmm. and in the political climate that we're living in, mm-hmm. it is seemingly to push us to not be silent and to step up and help correct others mm-hmm. when they're making mistakes. And there's mm-hmm. a lot of mistakes being made all over the place. Mm-hmm. So this is really like, okay, you know, we have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we have to speak up.
So 16 and 17 for me really stimulates my admiration for Marshall Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, using empathy ears out and empathy ears to myself and to the other person as opposed to critical ears to the other person or critical ears to myself. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I agree. I feel like 16 and 17 are almost like bookends. Like, you know, are you going to just be passive and hope people like you because you don't speak up, or are you going to be violent in your speech? Well, no, you don't have to do either one of those. There's this other dimension of care.
Yeah. Yeah, there's other ways to respond. Let's do another one. Number 18. Neglecting those who are angry with you by not trying to pacify their anger. Okay, so this is a situation where somebody's angry at us. Maybe we made a mistake. Maybe they misinterpreted something. But we don't try and calm them down. Okay? We don't apologize. We don't explain our behavior. We don't communicate in some way to try and help them release their anger. Okay, so this could come, maybe we're proud. Yeah, this person's mad at me, and okay, I said something that wasn't so nice, but I don't have to go to them and apologize. They're the ones who are so angry and insulting me right now. They're the ones who need to apologize to me. What I said was just one small thing. Okay, so having that kind of attitude, you know, I don't care if they're mad at me. I don't care if they're suffering. I don't need to apologize. I don't need to explain to myself. Okay, so, you know, we don't do this because we're arrogant, because we're still angry at them. Okay, so this is, here the object is a person who is mad at us. And we just say, you know, forget them. So why is this harmful? Well, you know, our behavior is just furthering the conflict, isn't it? You know, we're not being responsible, we're not communicating, and so we're just maintaining the conflict with the other person. Yeah.
What if they're just angry at you for who you are?
You mean like a situation of prejudice?
Like I'm a woman.
Yeah. If it's something like that, you have to see what the situation is, you know, and see sometimes, you know, there's nothing I can say. So it's best to be quiet. Other times, you know, you could say things, and here's where NVC could be very helpful. Yeah? If somebody is just angry at you and insulting you because you're a woman, to just say, you know, I feel whatever you feel, you know, I feel hurt or I feel offended. Yeah? Because I would like good communication, and I would like mutual respect in my relationships with other people. And just see what they say. Yeah? If you talk to them, if you talk about what they're doing and point fingers, you're going to get a defensive reaction. But if you just talk about how you feel, it is very surprising for the other person, I think. Yeah, they're rather surprised. Okay, so this is number 18. Yeah, so there's some exceptions here. So there's five, and one exception is for a good purpose. So if for some reason, it's better for the other person to be ignored because in the long run, it allows them to reinforce their good qualities or weaken their faults. So, you know, you can just ignore them. They're mad at you. You just ignore them, let them be. But then there's some other exceptions here. So the one is the angry person himself is malicious, ill-behaved, has bad intentions and wants to make us apologize to him. So if it's that kind of situation, somebody's mad at you and they're trying to manipulate you into apologizing and they really have a bad intention towards you, then, you know, it isn't a transgression if you neglect to try and pacify their anger. Okay? Because remember, this is somebody who's for whatever reason, is mad at us. Okay. Another exception is if apologizing would aggravate the situation by irritating the person further, perhaps leading to a fight. Yeah, because you know how some people are? They're like so mad that whatever you say to them, they just get angrier. Yeah, so then in those situations, better just let them cool. Yeah, let them chill out. Yeah, I mean, this is how I learned to deal with some family members when they get mad at me, I just completely, you know, because if I try and say something, it's like, who do you think you are to say something? No, no, no. So just whatever. Okay. I ignore it. Another exception is the person is naturally patient and would be indifferent to our apology. Yeah, so you came across somebody who's mad at you, but they're naturally patient. They don't need an apology. That's a rare person. Or maybe somebody who would feel uncomfortable if we apologized. Yeah, in that situation, we don't apology. Yeah, or if our apologies would embarrass somebody else, again, then it's fine to not apologize. Okay. We have a little bit more time for questions.
I just had something, a thing that happened where I kind of learned a lesson by applying the Dharma. It was at work. I was working on a project. My boss had given me what I thought was the responsibility for the project. Mm-hmm. But I was working with another woman who thought she had the responsibility. I don't know what was said, whatever. But I left her out of some of the communication. Mm. And she was very offended by that. I did not realize it at the time, but she let me know. And I was so upset because, you know, I would never have wanted to do that, didn't mean to hurt her, all this kind of stuff. I went home and just was, I mean, just thinking about it, I get, you know, that feeling again. But so I did apply some of this, and I thought, well, I need to communicate with her. And I was so scared to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, here is this woman, she just went off on me yesterday, you know, and I'm going to go and put myself in the line of fire again. But I thought, you know, I need to do that. I need to at least communicate and, you know, share my side of the story. And I felt better. I don't know about her, you know, because mm-hmm. She didn't really, I mean, she listened to me. We have a better relationship, I think, now. But I felt better about mm-hmm. the situation, at least. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sometimes brave to go and talk to somebody who you know is mad at you. Yeah. But if you go with the intention to try and settle the situation, it sounds like, you know, at least this person was able to listen and take something in.
So in my working life, I've worked about 20 years in customer service. And so it's like, yes, I've done this a lot. Because you have no idea what the situation is. And you have people coming up to you just frothing with anger.
Yeah.
And so there is some, you know, in other ways, training for doing this. And one of the first things they say is don't explain what's happened. They don't care what happened. They got a problem. They want you to fix it.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I've taken to doing is that the minute they come up to me and it's just, there's just the energy is just like a wall. Is to just say, thank you. Completely throws them off for a second, cools them down most of the time, just like that. To just say, okay, thank you. And then see what you can do about the issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Or especially offering them some empathy. Boy, you're really angry because you got this and you expected it to work and it doesn't. And they go, yeah. And then... But then, you know, they know you understand. And that's what they want is somebody who's going to understand and listen and help them.
Yeah, sometimes they just want someone to hear them, particularly older men, has been my experience. They're not, I mean, as in our society, as they're getting older, our older men are just not listened to or heard, or at least this is their feeling. And so if you take the time and just listen to them, sometimes they're you're like their best friend then.
Yeah. Customer service is a hard job. Yeah, but wow, what an opportunity to practice.
I have found what you've said here, that many times the angry reaction says a lot more about the person who's angry than you. And I think part of what I get into so much trouble is that any time there's a very strong reaction, no matter how hard I try to be clear or at least make an effort, there's so much personalizing. You know, there's so much about I, there's so much about self. And so that has been helpful to say, this is not mine. I can be open to hearing. And also to turn it back and say, my anger is not about them either. You know, so rather than taking responsibility for my own anger, but not jumping the gun and trying to take responsibility for somebody else's strong feelings as well. Mm-hmm. And when I see it within the context that this is about an afflictive mind right now that's suffering, whether it's mine or theirs, it sort of drops the whole thing down into a space of connection, because I can understand. And also it just softens the whole part of my mind that would be wanting to fight or flight. You know? So it's really helpful to know that afflictive states of not mine are generally not personal. Or if they are personal, it's my suffering mind. It's not somebody else causing my suffering mind.
Yeah. You know, it really helps. Yeah. But it is, it's quite amazing how we take things personally. You know? Boy, you know, we just instantly defense. Yeah.
Someone online says, now we know what we should do. What practice do we do to get to gradually move closer to being able to do that?
Well, you listen to the teachings about anger and how to practice fortitude. And as we've been talking here, we've talked about many antidotes here. Yeah. And you go home and you meditate on them. And you take out situations in which you have gotten angry and you contemplate those situations, seeing them from a new perspective. For example, what Venerable Semkhe was saying, you know, oh, somebody's criticizing me, but it's not personal. I don't have to take this personally. It's somebody else's feeling distress. Yeah, and so you rerun a situation you had in the past, but now you're thinking in a different way. Okay, and so you practice that way of calming yourself, or, you know, any of the other. We've talked many different kind of things to say or do or how to think. Yeah, and you just go back through your own life experience in your meditation and imagine being in those situations but with a different attitude. And you just practice it in your meditation again and again and again and again. And this helps you, you know, doing it helps you clear up a lot of things from the past.
Can you say more about liking a fight? What is behind this?
What is behind it? I don't know. What ideas do you have? Because I'm not somebody who likes to fight. Who likes to fight? And who here likes to fight? Okay, so what do you think is lying behind it?
Anger. Wanting the situation to change. And frustration.
Mm. So frustration and wanting to make the other person change, so the situation changes.
Maybe not the other person, but wanting to change something about that situation. But frustration, and also, yeah, frustration in like just things not happening as you would like.
Yeah, okay. So things not going the way I would like them to go and feeling angry and frustrated about that.
And not having the words to be able to articulate what is it that you need.
Oh.
And then that causes that, you know, wanting to fight because, you know, you see a problem, you want to be able to solve it, but you don't have the words for it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. When you don't, something's bothering you, or you have a need, or you have something, but you don't have the words to describe what's going on inside of you. You just have the raw anger and frustration. And so that comes out as wanting to have a fight, because that's, it's an attempt to communicate, I'm unhappy. Yeah? It's an attempt to say, I'm unhappy and I need some help, or I need something, but I don't even know what it is I need. Yeah? And you know, that's what we're really trying to say, but then it comes across as somebody else is yelling and screaming and you know, and blaming us, and we have no idea what's going on. Does that make some sense? Does that answer your question a bit? Yeah? Yeah, the person's trying to say something, but they don't have the words to express what they're trying to say.
I actually have another response to this.
Uh-huh. And, okay.
The first time my to-be husband met my father, we were visiting, we drove away, and he said, wow, your dad really likes to rile you up. And it was like this, you know. And I realized my father always would start fights with me and arguing about things, you know. And when I would, like, be winning the arguments, like having the logic on my side, he would switch to my position. And it would just drive me absolutely batty. And when my husband said that to me, it suddenly occurred to me that what my father wanted was attention. And so after that, whenever he'd start, and he knew things that I didn't like he would use the N-word, and he knew that that would always get me to pay attention. I would just, rather than respond to what he was saying, I would just say, I would ask him about his day, I would talk about his whatever project he was working on in the yard, whatever, and it was just this thing like, Walt needs attention, you know, and me and my husband would just tag team him with this overwhelming attention on him and what was going on for him. Yeah. And it was great.
Yeah. Well, this kind of fits in with what she was saying, because he wanted something, he needed something, but he didn't know how to say it. Yeah, so he picked a fight because that would get a reaction. Yeah. Yeah.
So kind of response to the question of, like, does anyone like to fight? Well, so I was kind of like that, but especially verbally, because growing up, we had this thing, it was called playing the dozen. So basically, you don't know what that means, it's like sort of one-upsmanship. And so we would talk about each other, and then we would go from there, you know, well, your mama this, your mama that. And so it, for me, and I think this sort of game, it was kind of like this thing of power. Like, who could be the most skillful with their tongue? So cutting as much as you could. So, like, sarcasm was great. It was my friend. And the more I could be sarcastic, the better. But also, I like to you know, like, what is it? Like, edge people, egg people on? Like get people going.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm thinking about it now, I always thought those were good qualities. And as you talked about early about how things are learned, so there's just something that we did,
yeah,
that kind of thing. So I thought it was good, but now I know it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's true. Very often with our friends, we get in one-upmanship, and who can insult the other person the more? Yeah, the most.
Yeah, I was in a relationship once where I learned that my partner at the time would never end an argument until she got me angry. And I figured out that it was because it was this, like, wanting me to be in this, feel the same things that she was feeling. Mm-hmm. And of kind of a pattern that developed around that of, if I was calm and I don't know if it was like I didn't care, or it was some kind of like need of mirroring emotions. Yeah. And so I think that's another piece of it in there. And I don't know how it tracks with these other pieces, but it was something that I experienced around getting into fights.
Yeah. For the person wanting, maybe that's how they felt that you understood them, as if you got angry just like they were angry. We human beings are so strange, aren't we?
My father used to like to rile people up, and I think it was just amusement for him. He was a truck driver, and he had a CB, and he would say things on the radio to get other truck drivers who didn't realize it was another trucker upset. And he was just amused by it. He would say things to people when they come to visit, just, you know, oh, I'll start talking to this person about nuclear power. Not that I care about nuclear power, but I know it's going to rile them up. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think some people do it for the boosting of the I.
Yes.
A big part of it.
Yeah. And there's a feeling of power. I have the power to make somebody upset.
Yeah, I've been contemplating the social situation at large and seeing a lot of this playing out, that both sides are feeling alienated and powerless, and it's expressing itself as a national fight, and not just politically. I mean, our entertainment is reality TV, where it's artificially set up as conflict, or talk radio. It's like we have no way to positively do anything, and so we fight.
Yeah, we've lost the ability to have civil discourse and to listen to each other. Sad.